From the studios of KPCW, of course, in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our relationships with it. I'm Chris Cherniak.
And I'm Nell Larson. We have three topics we're going to cover today. Right. First, we'll speak with Christopher Preston, the author of the new book, Tenacious Beasts, Wildlife Recoveries That Change How We Think About Animals.
That's right. The news about wildlife is dire. More than 900 species of animals have disappeared from the planet in the past 200 years. Against this bleak backdrop, however, there are also glimmers of hope and crucial lessons to be learned from animals that have defied global trends toward extinction. For example, bears in Italy, bison and wolves in the American West, alligators in Florida, eagles and osprey around the country.
These populations are back from the brink, some of them in numbers unimaginable in a century. How has this happened? What shifts in thinking did it demand? Christopher Preston reveals the mysteries and challenges at the heart of these resurgences.
Then we'll turn our attention to air pollution and the legal settlement recently finalized against an auto parts store that sold devices that, quote unquote, defeated anti-air pollution equipment on cars and trucks.
We'll speak with Johnny Vasek, executive director of the nonprofit Utah Physicians for a Healthy Environment, about the settlement, how it came about, and probably most importantly, what it means for Utah's air quality.
Right. And finally, we'll talk with Bob Deans. He's the director of strategic engagement with the Natural Resources Defense Council about the Willow Project and the Biden administration's recent approval of ConocoPhillips' plans to drill up to 200 oil wells within Alaska's National Petroleum Reserve.
Environmental awareness and education. That's what This Green Earth is all about. Stay with us. Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak.
And joining us now for the first part of the show is Christopher Preston. And he's the author of the new book, Tenacious Beasts, Wildlife Recoveries That Change How We Think About Animals. Christopher, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me on.
So Chris and I were really excited to see the content of this book, right, because it was shockingly, it was positive news. It was about success stories, and that's not something we get to talk about a ton on an environmentally focused show.
The dire stories, as exactly, we say in introduction, yes.
Exactly. So to kind of kick it off, you know, tell us about how you found these stories and what kind of motivated you to write this book.
Well, I wrote a previous book about the takeover of the natural world with technology, and I thought, well, that's a little depressing. I also realized it was never going to be complete because there's a resilience to biology that keeps pushing back against all of our best laid plans. And when you think about when we got locked in our homes during COVID, we were retreating off the streets and animals were kind of poking their noses back on the streets. Mm. We all seemed surprised. But this is what biology does, is it looks for an opportunity. It looks for a chance to come back. I wanted to dig into some of those stories.
Right. And so in the intro, we talked about some 900 species, though, that have been removed or wiped off the planet. Give us some examples of what some of those species are. And I'm assuming these are hundreds of species that were removed or now extinct due to human hands?
Sure, yeah, that 900 number is about human impact. And think about like the Carolina parakeet, the ivory-billed woodpecker, the Stella sea cow. You know, there's no doubt that we've had a heavy hand and, you know, things are gonna get worse. So I want everyone to be clear, this book is not trying to persuade you that, hey, you don't need to worry, there's no biodiversity problem. There really is a biodiversity problem. But if you find the good news, that can provide a little bit of inspiration, a little bit of hope. And I think, you know, if you have a vision of what it looks like, and what it feels like when animals start to return, I think that can motivate a good deal of activism.
Right. And just to add, I mean, the 900 or hundreds of species of animals, that doesn't include species associated with, say, insects or fish or, you know, other marine life. So it's probably in the thousands that species that have been impacted by, again, human hands or so. But you, like you say, Christopher, there are other species that, well, have gone to the brink of extinction and then for one reason or another have recovered. We mentioned a few in the introduction too, the bison out west, wolves out here in the American West and around the country, around the world. alligators in Florida, eagles and osprey here in the country too. Are those examples of animals that were pushed to the brink, again, by human hands, but for one reason or another have managed to recover?
Sure, and you know, sometimes it's pretty remarkable how little you have to do to help them recover. Mm-hmm. One of the most basic lessons I learned when researching these species is a good start is to stop killing them. that actually works pretty well. And in the case of the humpback whale and the sea otter, that's exactly what needed to happen. A change in law, change in practice, you stop killing them and they start coming back. And you know, wolves in Europe are a pretty interesting case. I followed the story not so much in the American West, but in countries like the Netherlands and Belgium in Europe. Wolves have come back to every country in continental Europe, and they haven't been released. They haven't been physically restored by humans in any of them. They've made their own way back. And so it really is sometimes remarkable how little you have to do for animals to recover.
When you tell the story of some of these animals, like I'll use this sea otter as an example, you start to share not only how this species rebounded, but then what other impacts it can have kind of in the habitat as a whole, right, down sort of down the chain in the ecosystem. Can you give us maybe share an example of that?
Yeah, that was actually one of the most exciting parts of the book for me. Sea otters are a good example. When sea otters come back, they have huge appetites. They've got to stay warm, so they need to eat a lot to stay warm. And they eat sea urchins. And that's actually great for the ecosystem, because if you remove enough sea urchins, the kelp forests come back. And the kelp forests are amazing nurseries for young fish. They're also really good at sucking carbon out of the atmosphere. So it turns out that when sea otters return, they're doing us lots of favors, not just in terms of helping the marine ecosystem, but also helping the climate. And so I actually try to push through some of these cases new attitudes towards wildlife. So, you know, why not think of a sea otter as an ally or a partner in the climate change battle? And I try and let these messages filter through so that we can adopt some better attitudes towards wildlife.
Can we apply that to more controversial species like wolves?
Well, it's certainly, you know, difficult. It's not always easy when a species comes back. But, you know, there are interesting examples with wolves. In the state of Wisconsin, they found that expenses due to traffic accidents have gone down since wolves have recolonized because they affect the movement of deer on the highways. And so there's actually a benefit from the recovery of those wolves. Close to where I live in the U.S. West, there's obviously the economic argument and the economic benefits that wolf watching brings to regions like Yellowstone. So, you know, wolves are definitely a lightning rod. And I wouldn't, if I was making the case, I wouldn't start with wolves as, you know, great examples of how to change an attitude. But we do know more about them now. We know how smart they are. We know how adaptable they are. We know how to keep packs together and not to create dispersal effects. And so I think there is room, even with wolves, to adopt a new, more 21st century attitude.
I remember we did an interview years ago with a researcher who discovered that the introduction of wolves even helped populations of trout in streams, because the wolves started to control the population of elk and moose who were eating at the willows along stream banks. The willows serve as a physical support for the stream banks, which improve water quality, which help the trout. So again, to Nell's point and yours, there's a ripple effect, there's a ripple effect associated with the saving of one species and the benefits, not just to other species, but to ecosystems as a whole.
Yeah, so this notion of a trophic cascade,
yeah.
I mean, that notion wasn't around when some of these species were wiped out. And so now we have that. We have that in our back pocket. We have a fuller understanding of the ecology and some of these keystone species. So obviously wolves are one, but sea otters are another, bison are another. We know that they provide more than just something good to look at or just an interesting addition to the landscape. They actually anchor the whole landscape. And usually that's to our benefit. So I think we can look at them with new, fresh attitude.
You share so many great examples of tenacious wildlife in the book. How did you choose which stories to include? And were there any that, like, I don't know, maybe resonated with you personally or kind of stuck out to you?
Well, a lot of them were species that I just happened to have bumped into through my work. I actually work in environmental philosophy, strange discipline, but it's thinking about the relationship between humans and the natural world. One of my favorite stories was when I was in Italy and I was chasing down the story of the Marsican brown bear. There's only been 50 of them for the last century or so. So that's a tiny population. They've just been hanging on by the tips of their claws, if you will. And I encountered environmentalists who were pruning apple trees, abandoned apple trees in the foothills of the Apennines, in order to provide food for the bears outside of town, because the last thing they wanted were these few bears to come into town. So by pruning these apple trees, they could keep the bears in the foothills, and it was working. That number 50 is creeping up. It's now thought to be around 70, and there'll be a genetic count next year. So just by paying really close attention to these tiny things you can do, you can start to get recoveries, and these tenacious beasts can show just how tenacious they really are.
In the remaining few minutes, what species would you say are still have a ways to go, or remain under threat?
Oh well, there are thousands of them, and let me sort of be clear again that I profiled 12 to 15 species in this book. Kind of depends on how you count them, but there's a million species under threat of extinction, and so we've got several hundred thousand we could think of here. But the message I really try to convey is that you can't expect species to survive only in parks or in wilderness areas. This is really a matter of cohabitation. This is a matter of figuring out better attitudes and learning what we can do, maybe just to change a little bit, just to adapt a touch, and maybe using what we know now about species to learn how to share a landscape with them. And I think the potential is huge, but to be sure, there's a long way to go.
Right, and now not only do you have industrialization or development that the typical suspects that threaten species, now you have a changing climate and a warming world and all the consequences associated with that that add additional pressure to these species, and so the work becomes more difficult in that way, not only for the species but for us to try to make changes.
Well, that's for true. I mean, climate, definitely adds an additional factor here. But small steps can go a long way. And the 30% by 30 movement, protecting 30% of landscapes by 2030, if you can secure these refuges, if you can protect landscapes where animals can reproduce freely and be left alone, those sorts of steps can be remarkably beneficial. And, recently the high seas were protected, or at least intent to protect by the UN, 30% of the high seas by 2030. And fish are so prolific that if you do create these refuges, these sanctuaries, then I think the prospect perhaps is a little brighter than we typically think.
Well, I know that we have to let you go and move on to the rest of your day, but I have to say that reading the book is sort of like, it's sort of empowering to see changes that have been made and then resulting kind of positive impacts in the environment. And so we want to thank you for that.
Real quick, we've seen changes here too. Yeah. If we can localize that with populations of healthier populations of certain deer and elk and moose, and then the ripple effect there, increased populations of mountain lions too. So there's a whole obviously it's very complex. And then our relationship with those animals gets complex, because some people don't want mountain lions, some people don't want coyotes, some people don't want wolves in and around them. There's a lot of relationship building that has to go on here. Resurgence.
The hardest thing. The hardest part.
So, for sure. But I sometimes lay down the challenge to people, now that you've heard this story, keep your ears and eyes open and see what species are coming back in your area. Yeah. You might be surprised.
Yes. I love that.
Yeah.
If our listeners are interested in learning more about your work and this book in particular, where would you direct them?
My website is christopherjpreston.com, and there's a whole bunch of information about the book up there.
Fantastic. Well, that is Christopher Preston, the author of the new book, Tenacious Beasts, Wildlife Recoveries That Change How We Think About Animals. Thanks so much for joining us this morning, Christopher.
Yeah, thanks.
I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome back to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about our relationships with and impacts upon the environment. I'm Chris Cherniak.
I'm Nell Larson.
And joining us now is Johnny Vasek. He is the executive director of the Utah Physicians for a Healthy Environment. Johnny, thank you so much for joining us this morning on This Green Earth.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Well, you're here to talk about a recent legal settlement, that the Utah Physicians for Healthy Environment helped to kind of champion. Why don't you give us a little thumbnail sketch about this settlement?
Well, yes, thank you. Stepping back a little bit, we had a lawsuit against the Diesel Brothers a few years ago, and it was basically involving modified parts on diesel trucks, whether that's catalytic converters or electronic tuners. And we won that case, and then they appealed, and then we won an appeal. And that set a precedent. No other citizens group has used the Federal Clean Air Act to go after mobile source emissions. So we set a bit of a precedent there. And then we saw that Four Wheel Parts was doing similar things. Now they're a national company that sells parts in their stores and through the internet. And we collected evidence on that and went after them. And what we wanted them to do is stop selling illegal parts, pollution defeat devices. And we basically came up with a settlement. It still needs to be approved by a Utah Federal District Court, but we feel strongly that that's going to happen. They agreed to a penalty and to end nationwide the selling of illegal pollution defeat devices.
So for those of us who maybe aren't as knowledgeable about vehicles and how these things work, can you give us a description of what these pollution defeat devices are and the different ways that they work?
Sure. Yeah. So, of course, all pollution is not created equal, and pollution out of diesel trucks can be bad already. But when you bypass the catalytic converter, which is the part in the car or truck that pulls the really bad pollution out of the air and sequesters it in the device, and that helps with the PM2.5 and those other fine particulate matter that can be released into the air and that can enter our lungs and cause many, many different health problems. And so we've gone after companies, and this is a good example with Four Wheel Parts, where they're either selling things that are like called straight pipes, which bypass the catalytic converter, or they may do something like an unapproved electronic tuner. Many trucks and cars now have a lot of computer technology in them. And when you bypass the electronics for the catalytic converter, it can create what's called that rolling coal, or when you see a diesel truck really hit the accelerator and all that black smoke comes out the back. That's generally a modified pollution defeat device, and that's called rolling coal, and that black comes out the back, which is not good for us. It's health damaging. And by doing that, you can cause a 20-fold increase in the pollution coming out of the vehicle.
Okay, I'll ask the more mind-boggling question you can attempt. Why in the world would somebody want to put these devices on their diesel trucks or other cars or so, simply to produce black smoke?
Yeah, well, it's a weird. That's a great question, and it's a tough answer. But right. I think it's part of it is this machismo thing of driving a really loud, stinky, ugly, polluting vehicle. It will give them more torque to the vehicle. It'll give them more power in the vehicle. But ironically, it actually will reduce the life of the engine by doing that. It's more about just wanting. I don't think it's the black smoke always that they want, but it's that extra power or they say it stifles the engine ability to do what it needs to do, that kind of thing.
Right.
We didn't really think it was that big of a problem, but after, you know, our group started looking into it, it is a rampant problem and something the EPA honestly should be taking care of, if not, at least the Utah Department of Environmental Quality and Air Quality should be on this, but both of them declined to get involved with this lawsuit so far. But I will say the great thing about this sort of thing and busting the bad guys, we're not looking to put anyone out of business. We just want them to simply follow environmental laws. And with this settlement, there'll be several hundred thousand dollars that will go to Davis County and Weber Morgan Health Department to help vehicles, especially for middle and low income people that they didn't tamper per se, but they're just their truck or cars out of emission compliance. And there will be a fund that will help those people get their cars in compliance. UPHE, our group, doesn't get any money from this settlement. It either goes to that or it goes as a penalty to be paid to the EPA.
Why Davis County and the Weber Morgan Health Department? Is that where
you have to have standing in a case like this. And so even though this is a national company, we really could have only forced them to stop in Utah. And those two specific counties we had, that's where some of the complaint lied. And also that they also have some of the systems already in place, like Salt Lake already has some of that in place and other counties don't. Some counties in Utah don't even require emissions compliance yet. But those two counties are some of the infractions were, and also where we there's also a system set up to put money into. So we would like that money to be statewide, but it's one step in a long battle to get companies to be good stewards in the environment, for the environment.
So you mentioned this one company, Four Wheel Parts. There's a couple of those stores in Utah. What's to prevent other auto suppliers or so to sell these parts?
Yeah, that's a great question. And other companies are still selling these parts. One great thing about them being willing to do a consent decree is they are saying they'll stop selling nationwide as well as in Utah, which is huge. They have hundreds of stores across the country. We hope this will be a wake-up call to any company out there that is illegally selling pollution defeat parts or tuners, and that we are on the lookout and there, you know, we may come after you if we catch you breaking environmental laws. I mean, these laws are there for a reason. It helps keep us healthy. And, you know, today's agreement will help reduce the harmful emissions, you know, from cars and trucks. So our goal is to improve the air quality for Utahns and if it can help throughout the country as well. So nothing yet to stop them. There are environmental laws in place. They're would have to be breaking, but we may come after them. You know, we're a small group, but we have a big reach. So there's, you know, we're looking out for that.
How was it that Four Wheel Auto Parts and some of these other companies have been able to sort of get away with something that's illegal for so long? Is it just a bandwidth issue on the part of enforcement, or is it a lack of data? Like, what's the mechanism there?
Yeah, I think that's true. All of that's true. I think there's a lack of enforcement. I think the EPA, you know, as controversial as they can be, there's many good people in the EPA trying to do good work. They just simply don't always have the bandwidth or the political will, honestly. There's a lot of companies with a lot of power and a lot of sway, and they just haven't really taken this on. Although I will say, since the Diesel Brothers lawsuit, which we've been fighting for 6+ years now, and even though we've won, it still can be challenging to get the money out of them to pay the penalty or to put it into, you know, compliance programs. It's a challenge, but the EPA has recently said this is on their radar and they are looking to step up their enforcement. So that is heartening that hopefully they can be a partner in this with us. And we would like to encourage the state to get involved. I mean, the Department of Environmental Quality, this is right in their lane, and they could step up and enforce these kind of things as well. But I think it's just, there's a lot of problems, and what do you focus on? You know, so hopefully we can shine the spotlight in this. It seems like a small thing in certain ways, because it's people just modifying their trucks, or dealerships modifying people's trucks, which is also illegal. But it has a cumulative effect, and it's happening thousands of times a year. It's not just a few isolated incidences. So every win like this is going to be a big victory for fighting towards clean air.
All right, well, we got to wrap up. Where can people go to learn more about the UPHE's efforts and this settlement?
Yes, we, you know, our website's a good place to go, uphe.org, or follow us on Facebook, and you can get lots of more information about this.
All right, Johnny Vasek, he is the executive director for the Utah Physicians for a Healthy Environment. Thank you, as always, Johnny, for joining us this morning on This Green Earth, and we will stay in touch.
Thank you so much.
All right. Welcome back to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about our relationships with and impacts upon the environment. I'm Chris Cherniak.
I'm Nell Larson.
Joining us for the remainder of the show is Bob Deans. He's the Director of Strategic Engagement with the Natural Resources Defense Council, and he's here to talk about the Willow Project. Bob, as always, thank you so much for joining Nell and me on This Green Earth.
Thanks so much, Chris. Great to be with you both.
All right, well, let's start with a little geography lesson, I guess. Tell us where the Alaska's National Petroleum Reserve is and where it might be with relationship to the ANWR, the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. I think I've got that right.
Sure do, right. Chris, it's right next to the refuge. It's up there on the sort of western part of the north slope of Alaska. And that's an area that is rich in biodiversity. It's very important and oddly fragile habitat for caribou, millions of migratory birds, fish. It's a real refuge. That's why the Alaska National Wildlife Refuge is in that part of the country. And so this is a very special place.
Yeah, in your write-up, in the NRDC's write-up, it says it's a piece of land that's the size of Indiana, first recognized by President Harding in 1923 and designated specifically for oil and gas development by the Naval Petroleum Reserves Production Act of 1976. So this is a piece of land that was designated for drilling and the extraction of oil and natural gas. Is that generally correct?
That is generally correct. It was designated more or less as a fuel tank for the United States Navy in 1923 when the Navy was shifting to oil, getting away from coal and shifting to oil. And so it was deemed a strategic resource at that time. Of course, a lot's changed in the past century. And we feel that if we could have drilled our way to energy security by now, we would have. It's been 100 years. The fact is there are cleaner, smarter ways to power our future now, and we think that should be the priority.
Will you give us a sense of the extent of the resource? Like, how much oil is there? You know, how long will it take to get to it? Like, what would that power you know, anything to help us get an understanding of what's there and why ConocoPhillips has been working so hard to get to it.
Sure. Great question. There is considerable amount of oil up there, and it would take between 6 and 10 years for that oil to reach market if ConocoPhillips began today on the project. Of course, we have filed a lawsuit to try to prevent that from happening. But again, you're talking 6 to 10 years, and let's look at what needs to happen in that time frame. We know that we need to cut our fossil fuel use in this country about in half compared to 2005 levels by 2030. So by the time this oil comes online, if we're going to meet our climate targets, if we're going to have a prayer of leaving our children a livable world, our oil demand needs to slide down over that very timeline that this oil would be coming on stream. So that's the issue. How much is there? It's enough to be about 1% of our consumption at current levels for 30 years. Again, look at the timeline. Between now and 2050, which is what we're talking about, we need to stop adding this carbon pollution to the atmosphere altogether if we're going to have a chance of confronting this climate crisis.
Right. I want to supplement what you just said, Bob, about 1%, because the Bureau of Land Management estimates that Willow could produce roughly 580 million barrels of oil over 30 years. Okay, that sounds like a tremendous amount of oil. When you break that down, that's about 19 million barrels per year. And that's one day's worth of U.S. consumption. Because if I got my numbers right, according to the U.S. EIA, we still consume roughly 19 to 20 million barrels of oil a day here in the U.S.
That's correct. And let's look at what's happening here. You know, electric vehicle sales in this country rose 70% last year. We're going to sell more than a million of those Chevy Bolts, that Ford F-150 Lightning. More than a million electric vehicles will be sold in this country this year alone. And as we move up to a target of half of all new cars being electric by 2030, we want that 20 million barrel a day oil consumption figure to go down because we know 40% of that oil is motor gasoline. And so that figure should be dropping precipitously as those people for whom an electric car is appropriate begin to shift to those modes of transit.
Is there some thought that this project could at some point in the future, like, just kind of fizzle out because it would no longer be economically like favorable if we're using less oil in 30 years from now?
Or it becomes more and more expensive to extract it than they anticipated.
Well, absolutely, because as demand falls, presumably the price comes down.
Yeah.
And then companies have to look at that. And of course, they look at it every day. That's why right now, or at least as the end of February, oil companies in this country were sitting on 6,653 permits to drill. In other words, nearly 7,000 permits to drill that the industry was actually sitting on, because they make these assessments constantly in view of the cost of production and the price of the oil. So there's every reason to believe that as consumption goes down, as demand goes down, price goes down with it, and that will absolutely change the economics of the equation.
What in this site, the Willow Project site, what are some of the primary environmental concerns? You briefly mentioned, you know, wildlife impacts and things along those lines, but could you expand on that a little bit?
Sure. The laws that oversee this, the National Petroleum Reserve Production Act, the Endangered Species Act, and the National Environmental Policy Act, these are the laws upon which we've predicated our challenge in the courts to this project. And what these laws require the Bureau of Land Management to consider ways to condition, restrict, or even prohibit certain activities. In other words, we say that they did not properly look at how to protect the resources there. So an example, this project would destroy enough wetlands up in that area to cover 530 football fields. Mm-hmm. We're talking about 250 miles of pipeline. And this, of course, upsets the ecosystem for the wildlife we've talked about. Caribou, brown bears, salmon, migratory birds, geese, and others. So it would upset that. The second piece of this is it didn't properly examine the risk of oil spills and the impact that can have on this precious habitat. And finally, they didn't look at alternative ways to cut the carbon emissions from this project. And just to give you an example, this project will have the same carbon emissions impact of 1.1 million homes. That's the number of households there are in the city of Chicago. So it's a big carbon footprint. It's a big carbon bomb that would last for 30 years. We just don't need that right now.
We're speaking with Bob Deans. He's the Director of Strategic Engagement at the Natural Resources Defense Council. We're talking about the Willow Project. Now, Bob, obviously, Alaskan Natives and ConocoPhillips and other companies that will benefit from the drilling activities and the infrastructure that's required, which is not for nothing, is quite complicated in and of itself. So there's always the question of, you know, the pushback, like, well, this is going to bring a lot of jobs up to those Native Alaskans who live up there. How do we respond to that?
The first piece of that is, what is the impact right now of the climate crisis is having? Alaska is experiencing warming that's far greater than the global average. And what that means is we're seeing permafrost melting. That changes everything in parts of Alaska. We're seeing wildfires in Alaska like we've never seen before. That is having an enormous impact. It's imposing horrendous costs and rising threats, hazards to the lifestyle of the people of Alaska. So that's number one. But if you want to look at short-term jobs up there, which is what we're talking about mm-hmm. here, because the construction is short-term, the production of oil long-term does not employ a lot of people. We just don't think that that justifies the damage and harm this brings to the region. And remember, a lot of these indigenous people are opposed to the project for the very reason that it would threaten indigenous foodways. There are native peoples who depend on caribou, who depend on salmon for their sustenance and their culture, their way of life. And the important thing to remember about jobs is this: if you want to generate jobs in this country, let's look at what's happening on the clean energy side. In other words, we're not stuck with coal, gas, and oil or nothing. Since the Inflation Reduction Act was passed in August, which, as you know, provides $370 billion over 10 years in clean energy incentives, just since that legislation was enacted, we have seen industry investing more than $70 billion to build solar panels in this country, to build wind turbines and components, to build advanced batteries for electric vehicles. More than 55,000 new jobs being created on this clean energy side. So when you want to talk about jobs, that's the way to produce them. That's actually happening, and it's happening in blue states and red all across this country.
So, considering all that we've talked about so far this morning, you know, I want to take a step back and ask, why did Biden approve this in the first place?
Well, that is exactly the source of the lawsuit that we have filed, because the Bureau of Land Management said that its hands were tied, that in essence it had to approve this. We believe the law not only gave, but actually compelled the Bureau to look at these other conditions, these other restrictions, and the actual prohibition of drilling in this specific area. And so that's what will be decided in the courts. And they'll take a look at our contentions. They'll listen to what the BLM has to say and what ConocoPhillips and others say. And we'll see where we come out. But I think one of the things that we've heard now is that, you know, you hear that in the wake of this horrendous war that Russia is waging on Ukraine, that energy security is a priority. Of course, it's important to remember, none of this oil is ever going to impact pump prices for, you know, perhaps another decade. It's not going to have any impact on the situation we're in with respect to Russia. What we say is that it is by investing in clean energy that we break our dependence on these very fossil fuels that are whipsawing our families and businesses owing to global price supply and shocks that we can't control, and that are actually padding the war chest of belligerent nations like Russia. We think this is another reason to invest in clean energy now.
Are there other Willow-type projects that are on the boards or in the pipeline with respect to the
terrible
national
pun.
I'm full of them. like that?
Well, Chris, the next big thing we're looking at is what's called the 5-year lease plan for offshore drilling in the Gulf of Mexico, and that's coming up this summer and fall. And what we're telling the administration is there is no place to continue expanding leasing in the Gulf of Mexico or on federal lands. And here's why. Right now, the oil and gas industry has access to enough ocean waters and public lands to cover the state of Georgia. They're using about 40% of it to actually produce on. So they have more than what they need to go ahead and move forward. And what we learned from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, from the report that they released just last week, and this is definitive, this is the last word on what's happening to our climate. And what that report said is, we have enough fossil fuel infrastructure, enough oil and gas pipelines, enough drilling sites right now to overshoot that 1.5 degree centigrade mark that we need to hold to avert the worst of climate catastrophe. There is no room for adding more fossil fuel infrastructure when we need to be phasing out our use of these fuels at home and abroad.
So with the last couple of minutes, I want to ask what's next. Like, is this decision definitely going to result in drilling? What are NRDC's next steps, and kind of where are we looking?
Well, the next step on Willow, of course, is going to be at the U.S. District Court for the District of Alaska, where NRDC has filed, along with our partners, Friends of the Earth, Defenders of Wildlife, Centers for Biological Diversity, Greenpeace, where we have filed this challenge. So that's the next step on Willow. The next step on cutting our carbon pollution in this country is coming before the Environmental Protection Agency, which in the coming weeks is going to issue new rules and standards to cut the tailpipe emissions from our cars, beginning with model year 2027. And very importantly, our dirty power plants, those that are still burning coal and natural gas. Together, our vehicles, cars, trucks, and dirty power plants are half of our greenhouse gas emissions in this country. It is imperative that we get robust rules from the administration to help us cut this dangerous carbon pollution so we can meet our target of 50 to 52% reductions by 2030 now.
All right. Where can people go to learn more about this project and the work that NRDC and others are doing, other environmental organizations are doing to draw attention to this project?
Chris, that would be nrdc.org. nrdc.org.
Okay. Bob Deans, the Director of Strategic Engagement with the Natural Resources Defense Council, thank you so much for joining us this morning on This Green Earth.
Thanks, Chris and Nell. Great to be with you.
Yeah. All right. Well, have a few minutes.
Before anything else, I have to just add to this conversation that we had with Bob Deans about this area up in the Arctic, because I obviously haven't been to the petroleum reserve, but I did spend a few weeks in the backcountry of the Arctic Refuge, which is right next door, so to speak. And it is so stunning and so fragile and so remote. And it's probably the only place I've ever been that doesn't feel overwhelmingly impacted, you know, by people. And so I know it's in the petroleum reserve, the area we're talking about.
Right, exactly.
But at the same time, it's kind of shocking to think about ripping that up and
drill pads and almost
it's
some 200 wells.
Hard to stomach.
Here's something a little bananas with respect to the engineering aspect of drilling. The best time to drill is during the winter.
Sure.
When it's frozen. You actually don't want to do it during the summer or the melt time. When, where you would think there's 24 hours of daylight and get a lot of work done.
No.
That's when drilling stops because of the melting. So actually, a lot of these pads during the summer, during the melt season, have to be frozen. So they actually have to keep these pads and their areas frozen. And what do? You have to burn it, consume energy to run these refrigerator systems to keep them frozen. That's how wacky and complicated and expensive, to Bob's part. The comment is this is all a function, the economics here, of a price of a barrel of oil.
Yeah.
The barrel price of barrel drops.
Yeah.
The value economic benefits of drilling up there decrease. Okay. Now we have 2 minutes. I was out last night with my pup and saw a couple of sandhill cranes.
Yeah.
They're there clattering and whatever the proper verb is for their calling.
Call.
Yeah. Screaming, yelling, otherwise.
Making their dinosaur.
What in the world are sandhill cranes and other great blue herons and other things like that? What are they eating these days, Nell? Where's their food?
Well, it is slim pickings.
Okay.
And I have to say, you know, we've seen the cranes come back to the Swanner Preserve. And where we saw them were in the areas that are so wet that they've already opened up the snow, that the water has melted the snow. So they were in sort of these wet areas of land kind of picking around in there.
So there are some wet, non-snow open areas.
Not many, not much. And we haven't seen them around. We haven't seen the cranes around as much. So I imagine they're looking at other places to feed and maybe even to nest. But I imagine they'll move back to the areas that they're accustomed to going to.
Okay.
They're just going to have to wait a little longer.
Wait. They have to be patient. Like that,
you know,
on I-80.
All the timing has to line up for
the
colts to be ready to migrate in the fall. But they're resilient, tough birds.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm sure they are.
Yeah.
They'll make do. Here's one interesting thing in the last 30 seconds or so is that out near a stream too, the meadow, I actually saw signs of bugs.
Yeah.
Some hatches are already starting because they just start, whether it's snow on the ground or not, I guess they're triggered by sun angles and the time of year and just conditions. Whether it's cold or snowy or not. So on a day a few days ago, when it was like today, sunny, warm, you know, 40 or something, there are some hatches. There are some bugs. They were dead in the snow, but they're actually occurring.
They're hatching out of the streams and the ponds.
And so I guess some of those birds will feed on that.
They'll have these things. And they still have the macroinvertebrates in there, the little insects. So they've got some options, but it's not an easy spring.
All right,
we have to wrap up now.
You can always email us your thoughts, comments, and ideas for topics and stories you'd like us to cover to thisgreenearth@kpcw.org.
The interviews for today's show will be posted on the KPCW website later today.
Thanks again for joining us. And remember, this is KPCW 91.7 FM Park City.
Tune in and listen like a local. NPR News is coming up next.